And this somewhat late but long planned is our commemorative program remembering the work, the achievement, and the delightful presence, in fact, of Milton Friedman, called by many the most significant economist, the most influential economist of the 20th century. My guests tonight are Sam Peltzman, an old friend who's been here often, professor at, an economist, of course, and a very important one, and professor at the Graduate School of Business, University of Chicago, also adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, and a major figure in the Chicago financial world, Leo Melamed, who was for many years the chairman of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. He now classifies as chairman emeritus, and he runs his own firm, of which he is chairman and CEO, titled Melamed and Associates. Let's just first talk about the man. He was a delightful fellow, Leo. You knew him well.
He was easy to be with. He was friendly. He was a gentleman's gentleman. He would actually give a chair to a lady. I mean, mm-hmm. something you don't often see in today's society. He was just a wonderful guy to be with. And, you know, he never gave you the feeling that he was somebody so important that you should be awed by him. Just the opposite.
What was he like as a teacher? You were his student, Sam, were you not?
Yes, I was. 47 years ago, minus a couple of months, I walked into my first class at the University of Chicago, and he was my teacher. There's a little bit of a contrast between what Leo just said, which is absolutely true. The man outside of class was utterly without pretense. He could easily get lost in a crowd, and all of that was true. But in the class, it was much different, much, much different.
Hard taskmaster.
Very hard. He would teach the first class that every graduate student took, and there were about 30 or 40 of us in the class, and the teaching style was something that I've never seen before or since, and it's very hard to reproduce what he did, but it was let's just say the Socratic method mm-hmm. taken to a very high level. He would sit in front of the class with a bunch of cards with our names on it, ask a question, randomly pick a name out. Rosenberg, what's the answer to that question? Uh-huh. It was a terrifying experience. you would be sitting there not knowing when you would be called and having to be able to respond immediately.
This rather reminds me of the representation of the famous law professor at Harvard in the film The Paper Chase.
I didn't see that.
Yes, I do remember that. And, you know, that's probably so, but I didn't know him in the environment that Sam just described, because I had heard him lecture, of course, and I used to sneak in to his class at the University of Chicago to hear him.
You only sneaked in? You weren't a paying student?
I wasn't a paying student. I once said to him, you know, this belies the fact that there is no free lunch, doesn't it? And he said, well, I don't think you ate very much. he had a good sense of humor, you know, again, delightful to be with. But when I saw him in the classroom, of course, I didn't see the classroom. This was lectures that I would come in where he was just the speaker. And of course, he had this force of logic that was totally undeniable. I mean, if you followed his stream of thought, you couldn't come but to his conclusion. There was no other conclusion in anything.
And that is the Socratic method, in fact.
Yeah, well, he was also very fast on his feet.
A rather intelligent fellow.
Absolutely. In the context of the back and forth, the verbal back and forth, he was very, very fast. And one or two of the students would rise to debate with him, and that was a mistake.
Always a mistake.
He was also rather elfin and given to a certain amount of kind of informal comedic repartee. I first met him when I'd only arrived at the University of Chicago. Within the first year or two, I was invited onto some committee. I forget what we were responsible for, but it was important. It had to do with the governance, I think, of the of the social science division in the college. But there were heavyweights on that committee. Among them, of course, Milton Friedman and the great Hannah Arendt, one of the major political philosophers of our time, who's half a year served at the University of Chicago in the Committee on Social Thought, a number of other quite senior figures. And I was the new kid on the thing. I was awed by Arendt, and I thought I should be awed by Friedman, but we had lunches once a month in which these weighty matters were discussed, and he was sort of the jester of the group, managing a kind of a light repartee of comedic improvisation around the issues that we were discussing, at the same time making some very good points in that light style. And then, when I started doing this program, during the first year or two that I was doing it, he came on. He was on a number of times until he left to go to the Hoover Institution in 76, I think, or thereabouts. And whenever the first time he came down here, he was absolutely smitten with curiosity about a radio station and its operation. And he was darting around, not only before the program, but during commercials, asking people about what they did. Popped into the booth back there to talk with the engineer and examine his operations and so on.
It sounds very much in character.
Yes, very much.
For him. And the fact that he wanted to do the show is another aspect of him. We'll get to more later, but he was a great communicator. I mean, he was quick on his feet, so it helped, but he wanted to reach out to the whole world, not just to us, to students.
Because ultimately he did, together with his wife, they did a major PBS television series called Free to Choose, was that it?
Yes. It was Free to Choose, yeah. It was in 1980, and the years following, and I personally believe that it changed the world. That television show got through to everybody. I mean, he talked at a level, it was economics, it was deep economics, it was a message of free markets, and free markets were not fully understood or known by the world, but that show, in the way he described it, the way he could show how it works, and it works for everybody, proved to this generation, I think our generation, learned from Free to Choose and the many other things that he did in a fashion that it changed everybody.
What did they learn? What was the basic message, not only in that series, but in the whole body of his work?
Well, first of all, that was 1980. In the mid-1960s already, he was writing popular works.
And yes, his book, Capitalism and Freedom.
Exactly,
was
I was going to mention that. Work. I think that's the predecessor to Free to Choose, and that I think is what put him at least on the road to becoming a an icon of some an iconic figure. To me, he was my teacher. To the rest of the world, he became an iconic figure, and I think Capitalism and Freedom was put
well, what's the basic message of that book? What was the basic message of that television series?
Well, you often identify the word Chicago school with respect for free markets, and that was certainly a part of it. There's many aspects to Friedman's message and how it was delivered. And I don't want to go into the technical economics that he's associated with. I don't think that's what he will eventually be remembered for. But the basic message that comes through in Capitalism and Freedom and in Free to Choose is a respect for the power of freedom to be put to the service of organizing the economy. If you read Capitalism and Freedom, again, as like Leo said, it's written, it's accessible to anybody, but it's deep. It has a deep message about how market forces can be harnessed for the greater good.
Here's a quotation. He says, "History suggests that capitalism is a necessary condition for political freedom." Then he goes on to add, "Clearly, it is not a sufficient condition."
Yeah, I, the message that I always repeated his message to me was that economic freedom coupled with political freedom is the best situation for mankind, and the environment that will produce the greatest good for mankind. And in Free to Choose, he proved that. I mean, he proved how the economic forces, when they're free, result in good for the general public, for the population as a whole. And it only occurs best when there is political freedom coupled with that.
Is he in this sort of a natural successor or inheritor of the tradition of Adam Smith?
Oh, absolutely.
He's a lineal descendant.
Directly.
Sure.
With some others on that line of descent, surely von Mises and Hayek are also very important.
They're a different tradition, but the same, very much the same message.
He actually, Milton has often said to me that Hayek was his teacher, so to speak. He often used that.
And Hayek, for a while, taught at the University of
Chicago.
Oh, yes,
I was a student of his.
He was his as well. Yes. He's a Viennese.
Yes, the Vienna School.
Yeah,
he's the Vienna School, which flourished in the late 19th century, peaked in the early 20th century, and then was utterly destroyed, of course, with the rise of Nazism. That was like in many other fields, a gift to first the British academic establishment, and then later ours. Friedman was instrumental in getting Hayek an appointment at the University of Chicago.
The difference between everyone else in the economists' world and Milton Friedman was that he could popularize his theories. It wasn't to a select audience that was very limited, that had to know, you know, real economic supply demand statistics and things like that. He could talk to the popular man, woman, and tell them how it worked, what it really meant to them. And he became, what Sam said, an icon to the whole world. There was no question that the word Milton Friedman, people, I could see the reaction when I talked about him. People, you know, it's as if they wanted to stand up at attention. After all, Milton Friedman said so.
I was in Washington for a week or so, a long time ago, on some research project with Congress. And having a few hours to fill, I went up to the Senate gallery, sat there, and watched them cavort and comport themselves, pursuing the nation's business. And they were on some economic issues and some economic bill, and one senator rose and quoted Milton Friedman. And another rose to say, you've got that quote wrong. And I know I've read more Friedman than you have, probably, he said, and I've talked to the man, and he quoted Friedman. And they were arguing as to which of them knew more of Friedmanian economics, yeah. But both of them were absolutely committed to using Friedman as the ultimate authority for whatever it was they were proposing. Well, back at the university a few days later, I ran into Milton Friedman on the quad, so to speak, and I told him this story, and he said, oh, they're always doing that, and they always get it wrong. We are tonight commemorating the life, the charming character, and the very great achievement of Milton Friedman. We are joined tonight by two good friends of his, Sam Peltzman, who started as his student and is now professor, indeed professor emeritus, at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business, and Leo Melamed, a very well-known figure in Chicago and indeed in the international financial community. He is now chairman emeritus of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, having governed that body for some 30 years, am I right?
That's right.
Yeah. Were you in on the merger that is now moving?
I was part of the transaction team.
Sure.
During the negotiations, yes.
Is it fully done? Is it a fait accompli?
It's complete. It's finished.
The Merck and the Board of Trade will be one.
Nothing will put us asunder.
And what do we achieve thereby?
Oh, I think great, great things. I think that Chicago, of course, will be a great beneficiary of the fact that it brought the capital of derivatives markets to Chicago without question. It gives the United States and Chicago a combination of two markets that will become a powerhouse of innovation in the years ahead as we compete internationally and over the counter. So it's bound to bring new businesses to Chicago, and it's bound to be a very, very successful one of the really great successful ideas in mergers. You know, not all of them are always great. This one is.
Sam Peltzman, For those who are confused by economics, what is a derivative market?
You could ask Lear. He could tell you.
I'm testing you.
Derivative means that it's a security which is based on something else. So the simplest derivative would be a corn futures contract. Mm-hmm. It's ultimately promised to deliver a physical thing, corn, at some point in time, but it gets its value as not because it is corn, but it's derived from some aspect of the corn, of the production and distribution of corn. And it gets much more complicated and sophisticated.
And the promise can be traded.
Yes.
So you can buy it for more or less, and you may buy it for less than the value.
Yes, and you can have an instrument which is a derivative of the derivative.
Yeah. Now, how does that apply to currency?
Well, of course, currency, in effect, the futures market was a derivative of the actual spot. Currency is currency and can be physically traded as well, and is. That's the big market in the mm-hmm. interbank market. The spot market trades several $1 trillion worth of currency every day. When we created a futures market in currency where you were dealing with the promise of delivery, it became a derivative of currency. In fact, there's an interesting sidelight to that. The great Merton Miller, who was also a Nobel laureate
at the
University of Chicago and a teacher, and someone who I became a very good friend of and was on the board of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, used to complain about the word derivative. He said it's sort of a pejorative thing. What, we aren't the real thing?
Yeah.
He would say to me, he had a great sense of humor. So that was his definition.
Now, there's a great story here involving Milton Friedman, and it has to do with your original move, you, Leo Melamed, to introduce currency trading into the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which until then was essentially dealing with agricultural commodities.
Well, when I became chairman in 1969 and thereafter the years that followed, the only thing that was traded in futures markets were agriculture. It was born that way 100 years before in the corn market, the grain markets, or in the case of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, it was butter and eggs, and later
and,
on
and
pork bellies.
Hog bellies. I've always
pork
loved
bellies.
That term.
Yes, very famous. It became the house that pork bellies built,
right,
as a matter of fact. But no one thought of using the same mechanism for finance, and I became imbued with the idea of having read a great deal about it, and mainly because Milton Friedman kept saying that the fixed exchange rate system known as Bretton Woods, where everything was set in a fixed way, so much, you know, the yen was worth so much to the dollar, the Deutschmark so much to the dollar, and so forth, would someday have to break down because it was an unrealistic and, in his view, inadequate system.
And other markets always existed which were more realistic. They were called black markets.
They were black markets. And the black markets always had a different price than the fixed or real market, so to speak, because it talked a different language. It talked reality. What does it really cost in the marketplace? But at any rate, at that time, when I thought of this, most people at the Chicago Merc and everywhere else thought it was a wild idea because futures were meant for agriculture, not for finance. And yet, I really believed that a foreign exchange one day could be a very, very big market and could launch some interesting new markets as well, not just foreign exchange. But no one believed me, and it was very difficult to move the board. I was very young at the time, and I wasn't an economist, so what did I know? And the only way in which I could prove, I thought, to the world and to the board of directors of the Chicago Merc was to ask an authority, and the only authority that was worth asking, I thought, was Milton Friedman.
And one day you're having breakfast with him at the Waldorf Astoria in New York.
I was having breakfast at my request in New York. It was July of 1971, and I asked him not to laugh because I was going to ask him a question that, you know, others have laughed at, and he promised he would not laugh. He, of course, knew who I was, and so I said to him, what would you say if I offered the thought of a currency futures market at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange? And he looked at me, he said, what a wonderful idea. You know, and I was kind of stunned because to me, this was the the god of economics. This was the icon saying that this idea had merit. And I said to him, are you serious? You don't think there's a problem in trading financial instruments in futures? And he said, I can't think of any. I said, no one's going to believe you said that. And he said, well, tell them I said so. And I said, no, they won't believe it. You got to put it in writing. And he laughed. He says, what are you suggesting? I said, well, I need something that says Milton Friedman said it's a good idea. He says, you want a feasibility on the need for a currency market in futures? I said, you got it. And so he laughed and he says, you know, I'm a capitalist. And I said, what'll it cost? And he said, how about $7,500 for a feasibility study? I said, you got it. Greatest investment the Chicago Merc ever made.
And that made it possible, you're quite sure.
Oh, absolutely. That paper, which he delivered in December of 71, I used as the biblical message, as it were, that the market that we were launching in foreign exchange and thereafter interest rates and stock in there, and we never stopped to this day. Was a good idea, and Milton Friedman said so.
There are two postscripts to that. Uh-huh. Well, one is, I didn't know the date was July 1971. Within a month, the last vestige of the Bretton Woods system collapsed. Yeah. And that made this this currency futures market much more important.
It was one of the strong things that Richard Nixon did. He, in essence, took us out of the Bretton Woods Agreement.
Yeah, and he had been advised by Milton Friedman, actually, to do so from the very day Nixon was elected. Of course, he waited too long.
Yeah. The other postscript is that financial futures, Leo mentioned interest rate futures, which have come to be much bigger, all of that dominates the trading at the Merc now. Mm-hmm. You'd have to go up into the top floor to trade pork bellies and milk and whatever.
Well, it's 99% financial.
99%.
Right? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And now the voice of Milton Friedman. From that very series we talked about before, the Free to Choose series done for PBS on television and shown around the world, I think, for many years following. I think Leo was saying earlier that series had tremendous influence upon governments, upon people, and in many ways was transformative with regard to economic managerial orientation. And here is Milton Friedman doing his very simple, beautifully illustrated commentary, and thereby conveying the essential principles of the Chicago School, one might say.
Look at this lead pencil. There's not a single person in the world who could make this pencil. Remarkable statement? Not at all. The wood from which it's made, for all I know, comes from a tree that was cut down in the state of Washington. To cut down that tree, it took a saw. To make the saw, it took steel. To make the steel, it took iron ore. This black center, we call it lead, but it's really graphite, compressed graphite. I'm not sure where it comes from, but I think it comes from some mines in South America. This red top up here, the eraser, bit of rubber, probably comes from Malaya, where the rubber tree isn't even native. It was imported from South America by some businessmen with the help of the British government. This brass ferrule, I haven't the slightest idea where it came from, or the yellow paint, or the paint that made the black lines, or the glue that holds it together. Literally thousands of people cooperated to make this pencil. People who don't speak the same language, who practice different religions, who might hate one another if they ever met. When you go down to the store and buy this pencil, you are in effect trading a few minutes of your time for a few seconds of the time of all those thousands of people. What brought them together and induced them to cooperate to make this pencil? There was no commissar sending out orders from some central office. It was the magic of the price system, the impersonal operation of prices that brought them together and got them to cooperate to make this pencil so that you could have it for a trifling sum. That is why the operation of the free market is so essential not only to promote productive efficiency, but even more, to foster harmony and peace among the peoples of the world.
As you were saying earlier, Sam, he was a great teacher. That's the mark of a great teacher, that he manages to reduce it to things we can easily grasp.
I have to tell you, Milt, that lecture that you just heard, he gave to our class 47 years ago.
It was practiced, wasn't it?
And it illustrates something very important about Milton and about the Chicago School as it's associated with his name. The message he was conveying to, we were graduate students in economics, and we got that lecture. The message he was conveying is economics is really not that complicated. There are some very basic forces, and you should look in the world for how these forces operate. You, as a professional economist, that's going to be your job. I didn't realize it at the time. I said, you know, what is he talking about, a pencil? He's talking about a pencil. He actually spent a whole quarter doing stuff like that. He would come in, open the newspaper, and say, I read this story. And then, as I mentioned before, he'd flip the card. Peltzman, what do you think about that story? And you'd, you know, be tongue-tied, and you'd say something. And you wondered, why is he telling stories, like just like the simple story you heard? About 6 months later, it hit me. I read the newspaper, and there was a story, or I heard a story on the radio, and I started saying, well, what is the underlying economic force? What are the underlying economic forces that would produce the connection that this guy is trying to get me to make? Is it logically consistent? Does it hold together? And I said, oh, my God, that's what Milton Friedman is teaching me. He's not teaching technical that economics is just a beautiful logical system. He wants me,
or a dismal science.
Well, he wants me to understand that everything about the world can be comprehended with a few very basic, simple principles.
Show me the connection between his work and the work of his student, Sam Peltzman. One of the things you're well known for is your work on the untoward and unpredictable dysfunctional consequences of governmental regulation of economic operation.
Well, actually, my doctoral dissertation chairman was Milton's best friend, George Stigler. Mm-hmm. So Milton was on my dissertation committee, but he wasn't the main force. But all of my life's work has been kind of to flesh out that insight that you should look for basic forces and how they operate. And the other aspect, which is kind of it's something that an economist would be more interested in than the general public, perhaps, is that the way you get insight in economics is not just through pure logic. At some point, you have to go out in the world and look and see if the economic models that you're spinning out actually explain what's going on. And that aspect of the Chicago School is really what motivated me. The reason, you know, if I have all the nice things that you said about me, if half of them are true, it's because the question I always asked was not what should regulation do or what in theory it might do, but how did it actually work in the world?
What are its consequences?
What are its actual consequences?
What is the Peltzman effect? This is well known in economic theory or modern economic science. It has to do with these very matters.
Well, I think that it originated in a study that I did of automobile safety regulation, in which, again, the very simplest economic logic, we're talking here about the very first generation of automobile safety devices that I actually studied.
Seatbelts and so on.
Seatbelts and so on. It's been studied subsequent to that. But all these things had the character that they would protect you if you got into an accident.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't directly designed to stop you from getting into an accident. It was, if you got into an accident, the consequences would be better. And they are. I mean, nobody doubts that. Well, you know, basic economic principle is if you lower the cost of something, people will tend to do more of it. So the simple logic that I got in the first class I ever took in economics, even before I met Milton Friedman, the simple logic would lead you to think, well, maybe if you lower the the bad consequences of getting into an accident, you'll induce more risk-taking. That's what's come to be called the Peltzman effect, that if you attempt to regulate risk, to reduce risk by regulation, you're providing an incentive to people to take more risk.
And is it thereby demonstrable from available data?
Well,
you then get more accidents.
Well, you're getting into the I don't know whether we want to dwell on my work.
Not too long,
my study of automobile safety regulation, which is now over 30 years old.
I know, yeah.
Showed that it was plausible in the world, not in theory, but in the actual world, that there was something to it. Okay, I actually made a stronger claim that there was the extra risk-taking exactly offset, that's why it's called offsetting behavior, exactly offset the favorable consequences of the seatbelt.
It raises a great question, or it's illustrative of a great question, which is at the center of Friedman's work and the work of the Chicago School, the question of what exactly is the role of government, if there is any desirable role at all for government in relation to enterprise.
Well, as little as possible is what Milton would have told you. I mean, his view of government was to protect the citizenship in terms from, you know, terrorism and war and things like that, and provide the regularity in terms of the laws of traffic and things like that, but not to do any kind of rules or regulations as it relates to the free market or that would impact the free market. In fact, I doubt very much that Milton, with all due respect, Sam, would have said that the regulation that you have to wear a seatbelt is correct, because
he would not have proved that.
No,
and it's my role was just simply to ask the question, what was happening?
Yeah, there's no denying that seatbelts can save your life and as a good safety mechanism, but that decision should be yours rather than government's. And that was his main theme in all that he taught.
Here's a quotation from the thought of Chairman Friedman. Many people want the government to protect the consumer. A much more urgent problem is to protect the consumer from the government.
Yes, that's very typical of Milton. Now I think he would have fleshed out a little more what Leo said. We haven't touched yet on his monetary economics, but he would have granted the government a role in providing a stable monetary background.
Only a few weeks ago, Amity Schles was here, who's done she's got a University of Chicago connection. She was a graduate of the University High School.
Is that right?
Yeah. A brilliant political, rather economic journalist, essentially. And she's done a major book on the Great Depression.
Yes.
With some very interesting reconstructing of how it happened and what was really going on behind the collapse of the economy. Milton Friedman concerned himself with that a great deal
as
well.
Oh, yes, of course.
And his analysis of what went wrong to generate the Depression has much to do with the further development of his monetarist approach in economic theory. In our program tonight, we are remembering Milton Friedman as a person, but also, of course, as a major contributor, perhaps the most important contributor during the second half of the 20th century, to the development of economics as a workable science which helps to improve how we live, improve how our economic institutions work, and helps us to avoid economic collapse, to avoid depressions. Now, he, of course, quite early in his career, got very interested in the Great American Depression. Just as Galbraith wrote a book titled The Great Depression, Friedman also addressed that question, came up with a very non-Galbraithian answer, as I remember it.
Yes, well, actually, in economics, his magnum opus is The Monetary History of the United States, which covers up to 1960, and of course a major monetary event was the Great Depression. Perfect example of a message of Milton's message. By the late 1920s, we were already 15 years past the establishment of the Federal Reserve. We had gone from a gold standard to entrusting the money supply to the government. And we did that because of a fear that the monetary system was somehow inherently unstable. And for years after the great calamity of the Depression, many economists said, well, you know, that's a perfect, the Great Depression is a perfect example of how the capitalist system is inherently unstable and why it needs government to be kind of steer it. And Friedman came along and said, you've got it all backwards. The reason the Depression happened, a major reason the Depression happened, is because we gave the money supply over to the Federal Reserve and it screwed up. There was a stock market crash and there was a series of bank runs. And to stabilize the monetary system, if you're gonna have the government at all responsible for the monetary system, the government has to do, the Federal Reserve has to do certain things. It didn't. The result is we had a great monetary contraction, Federal Reserve basically sitting on the side and watching the money supply contract. And that's why we had the Great Depression.
The Federal Reserve could have, instead of contracting or reducing the money supply or controlling it, could have increased the money supply.
Well, what happens when there's a run on the banking system and so on and so forth is that if you have a Federal Reserve, what it's supposed to do is basically to provide lots of reserves to the banking system.
To cover the action.
Lots of reserves. If people are pulling money out of the banks, just offset, you have to offset that. Federal Reserve did not do that, although there were forces within the system that wanted to do it. Eventually it didn't do it. And in a government-run system, if you don't do it, the system can implode, and that's what happened. The money supply fell by a third, and Friedman's whole analysis of that episode shows you how dangerous it is to rely on discretion, government where the bureaucrats have discretion in what they're going
Friedman
to do.
Friedman made a transition from being early in his career a Keynesian, essentially, to being something quite non-Keynesian. Well, was that the transition?
I think it's a little bit, there's a little bit of a history here. The Chicago economists who were teaching Friedman as a graduate student had a Keynesian, what you might think of as a Keynesian bent, in the sense that they probably bought a little of the idea that there was an inherent instability that had to be offset by government spending if we got into a little recession to prevent it from being a depression. Friedman himself always was skeptical about that, and his ideas weren't fully formed in the monetary area until he started with Anna Schwartz doing this monetary history of the United States. But I have to say, as long as I knew him, he was always skeptical of that view. So he was a little bit, I guess, ahead of his teachers. But his teachers, for surely at Chicago in the 1930s, you'd have to say had a Keynesian bent. Well, there wasn't called that then.
Friedman, in the last 20 or so years of his career, was often in China. Did he have anything to do with pulling China away from a managed quasi-Stalinist economy to an entrepreneurial economy, even though still done under the name of communism?
Well, you know, I talked with him quite often about that, and he'd like to think, well, I would like to think that he liked to think that, yes, he influenced a Chinese leader. Dao Xiaoping, who is credited with, of course, being the economic force that changed China and put it on the road to economic more or less free enterprise, as it presently is that road it's on today. Communism almost single-handedly proving to the world that free markets work better for the people and for the economies of the nations.
So he did as much to end the communist tyranny as did Ronald Reagan, say.
I would say even more.
But by the power of his ideas, I don't know that he had any personal influence in China. But if you go to that PBS series you talked about, there's a whole one of the programs is about Hong Kong.
Yes, I do remember that.
And the contrast between Hong Kong on the one hand and China at that time on the other.
Here's an interesting angle on the career of Milton Friedman. I simply put this to you as a question. How do you relate the following to what we've already revealed about Milton Friedman? The following being his advocacy of the legalization of marijuana, the legalization of prostitution, the provision of vouchers to enable people to pay off the schools, public or private, to which they send their kids, and for that matter, his advocacy of what he called the negative income tax. What did that have to do with the kind of economics we've been talking about?
Well, all of them have to do with very simple economic forces and how you harness them for particular ends. They're different, and you know, you have to really pay attention to the differences too. In the case of legalization of drugs, he was very clear-eyed about what the likely effects of that would be. It's the question is what you might like to happen in an ideal world, but what is the best alternative? And he recognized that there was a trade-off. If you have legalized drugs, there'll probably be more people taking the drugs, but the legalization would get rid of a lot of crime. And his view was, on the whole, as it wasn't with much about the world, on the whole, you're better off leaving people to their own devices rather than trying to regulate their behavior. Not that it would be perfect. One of the things he always said was, I absolutely refuse to let the best be the enemy of the good.
Uh-huh.
And this is a very good example. It's not that having drugs around is kind of the ideal world, but people should be left to their own devices, and you'll get rid of a lot of social costs doing that, namely crime. Now, school vouchers, same general idea. We have essentially a public school monopoly.
He wanted to return competition
in
the educational business.
That drove him to the school choice idea.
Yes.
Of course, that is the theme of almost everything in his mm-hmm. Theories and in his direction, is that competition will produce the best result for the end result that you're looking for. In the case of drugs, as Sam indicates, that's a different thing. His motivation was to do away with crime, and obviously that might be the result, but there are some, you know, he recognized the negative fallout of that. But in schools, it was simply the underlying force of that competition will bring the best teachers to the fore and the best results for the children, and also, result in better for those that the ones that can less afford would end up in better schools as a result of the competition.
Milton made a fair amount of money, as he should have, and he then established a number of years ago, I guess, his own foundation. I guess it's the Milton and Rose Friedman Foundation,
yes,
isn't it? And one of their main commitments is to push the voucher plan.
That's their exclusive commitment.
It's the exclusive
it's,
one.
It's to
How do they do it?
Well, they do it by education and
mm-hmm.
Publicity. They're not, as far as I know, politically connected or anything of that sort.
No, but you're right.
Yeah, but this was in his last years. This was his number one priority, very clearly. Advancing the idea of school
choice.
How is
the voucher movement doing in this country?
Well, it's slow.
It's mixed results.
Mixed, but
Milwaukee
but
did a good deal of it some
yes.
years ago.
They do it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Milwaukee has the difficulty has been that the voucher systems that are in place now are limited to poor people. And that's good, and Friedman would have nothing against that. But in order for it to really succeed, it has to be universal across the board,
mm-hmm.
and not it can't be thought of as just something for people who are unfortunate.
You know,
but we're talking about vouchers now. If you have the kind of perspective that I have, and I suppose that Leo might have, he first broached that idea in Capitalism and Freedom 40 years ago and was thought to be a complete nut. And here we are talking about Milwaukee, Cleveland's got a program, the state of Florida wants to institute a program. It shows you really how far we have come. There's a long way to go, and it hasn't gone as fast as I think Milton would have wanted it to.
The main problem there are the teachers' unions.
Well, it's a very big problem, but I think it's Sweden, socialist, welfarist Sweden, the whole country has vouchers. So it's moving.
I think you've got to understand his ideas in the long run, as you're suggesting. You can't always, I mean, flexible exchange rates are today, you know, the way of the world.
But it took 50 years.
It took a long time for that to be an accepted idea. Voluntary armed force that we have today, that's Milton Friedman.
Yes, he was very much opposed to the draft, wasn't he?
Yes, and again, the underlying theme, of course, is competition and the freedom of choice and to do these things. He understood that the time horizon for many of these ideas, he didn't think that we would that we would legalize drugs overnight. He understood how, difficult that idea was, as is a school voucher program, because the unions are so strong and so forth. But that didn't dissuade him.
Remind us what the negative income tax proposal was.
Well, I think I'll let that
decide. The negative income tax actually has come to pass. It's called the earned income tax credit. It's not exactly his idea of a negative income tax, but it comes very close. It's a very good example of the power of his idea.
How did he formulate it?
Well, his formulation was, look, we have all of these welfare programs. They're all top-down. They're all giving people things, and they're inefficient because people can choose for themselves better what they want than the government can choose for them. And secondly, they reduce the incentive to work. So his idea was, why don't we scrap all of that stuff? Excuse me. Why don't we scrap all of that stuff and have a very simple line item on a tax form? If you earn below a certain amount, you get a tax credit proportional to how far below you are this cutoff. So it would be a negative income tax. Your income would be below this threshold, so that's the negative part, and a tax would be a rate would be applied to that, and you would get a check from the government. So if you're very poor, you earn nothing, you would get more than somebody who earned something, and you wouldn't have, it wouldn't be 100%, it would be some number less than 100%, so you would have an incentive to work. Well, that's what the earned income tax credit is, except it applies only to earned income. It isn't completely the same idea, but it's close enough. If your earned income is below a certain threshold, you get a check from the government, and then we ended welfare as Friedman knew it 10 years ago, much to the chagrin of many pundits at the time. They thought the world would come to an end. It hasn't. It hasn't. So I think that's one of his more successful ideas, as is the volunteer army, which we now take for granted, but which, as Leo pointed out, was absolute heresy when he was pushing it.
Take him all in all, he was a man we shall not look upon as like again, in all probability.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
And with that, we go to the first caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. It's interesting. Thanks for taking our call. It's interesting to hear these gentlemen attributing so many good things to Milton Friedman's ideas, but don't you also have to give him some of the responsibility for some of the problems? For example, this what could be called an obscene concentration of wealth, which is easily traceable to higher interest rates and uncontrolled interest rates, which I would ask your guests, wouldn't Friedman have supported removing government regulations on interest rates, which we had in effect until about 1980-81?
Well, a challenging and interesting question. Leo Malamba.
Well, I don't think that he would have, he certainly was of the mind that the intervention by the Federal Reserve could be diminished, there should be diminished, there should be held to a minimum. I don't know, Sam, would he have abolished the idea of interest rates controlled by government completely?
Oh, absolutely. I think Regulation Q is what the caller is referring to. There was a cap on interest rates that banks could pay to you. There was no cap on what they could charge to lenders. That was a disastrous regulation.
The disaster is when it was removed.
It led to the near collapse of parts of the banking system. I'm sorry, I have to disagree with
that. That collapse.
Let me say something more generally about where Friedman was coming to. You pointed out about the concentration of wealth and all of that kind of thing. Friedman's advocacy of the market often is looked on the way this caller is kind of representing it. It's something which may have some good effects, but it's really for rich people. It's really something that benefits rich people. That was totally antithetical to where Friedman himself was coming from. He viewed free market forces as good, not because they benefit the rich or they concentrate wealth, but because, on the whole, again, there's one side and there's another. But on the whole, the ordinary person will be better off if you let free market forces flourish.
Gentlemen,
you may have wealth more concentrated, but you'll have more of it, and that second aspect will be the much more important one. And I think historically, over the long run, I think that's true.
Back to the caller. Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, I think if you look at the facts, which you said earlier you like to do, the lives of our average people is going downhill here.
That's not true.
Well, that's not true.
That's just not true.
It is true. If you look at family life, both the husband and wife have to work now, and the men sometimes working at more than one job. It is true. Now, until 1980-81, we had between a 6 to 10% limit on interest rates by each of the states. They did it on a state level, and that banking crisis was caused by Reagan's removal of the regulations on savings and loans. So government regulation was a good thing there. I'm glad to hear this on the radio, what you guys are saying, because Mr. Malamud will understand. You have reached saturation point with these ideas. They have only one place to go.
And what is that place?
Downward. Out. We're going to examine what the results are rather than the theories. At theories.
You've a major point with considerable articulateness and even some passion. Hold still now for some response. Leo Malamud.
Well, I really don't think that's true at all. I think that the free market principles of Milton Friedman have been embraced by the world over to the good of the general public and to the good of the most depressed, as a matter of fact, and the lowest income levels have risen. You're comparing the United States maybe to the rest of the world, and the United States reached a level of standard of living that was unbelievable in times past, and the rest of the world is trying to catch up. Maybe they're on a higher incline right now because they have a lot more room to catch up. But all of the reasons that are today producing the results of standards of living, whether it's in India or in China or South Africa, are the result of the free market process and the ideas of Milton Friedman. I think that the embrace of those things has produced this general good in the world, and I don't think that is on a downward slope at all.
And with that, we'll consider, we have to consider that a fair exchange. Many other people are clamoring for the air. I thank you very much for a most interesting contribution, and to another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, am I in the air?
Yes, sir.
Good evening. What do your guests think that Milton Friedman thought regarding abortion? Was he pro-life or pro-choice? And how did he justify his view? And also, would he have been for or against the conservative attempt to pass an amendment banning gay marriage, again, how would he justify his view? My guess is that conservative Republicans would have opposed Milton Friedman on this, on these issues, because I would assume that he was very libertarian and would deviate from their thinking on it.
I think that's exactly right. I think your summation is correct. I think he was a libertarian heart and soul, and would have again had the view that free choice is the only answer to both of those issues, or to many issues like that. And the far right conservative, although he was a Republican true and blue, the far right or the conservative would not have maybe agreed with Milton on these issues.
Interestingly, the leading public libertarian these days is Ron Paul. Though he's in Congress as a Republican congressman, he once was the libertarian candidate for the presidency, as a matter of fact. And we know that he's been an outspoken advocate of instant withdrawal from Iraq. If Milton were, well, Milton only left us about 7 or 8 months ago. How did he approach that issue?
I have absolutely no idea.
Well, I actually
nor would I be as confident as Leo about the other two issues.
Well, I
because they're more nuanced than just mm-hmm. freedom and regulation.
Actually, Sam, I did speak to him on all three of those issues.
Did you?
And as a matter of fact, I was totally surprised 4 years ago when we were discussing the issue of going to war in Iraq or not, and eventually, of course, we did. And I thought that he would support the president, as, you know, did most of the American public at the time, and certainly Republicans at the time. And to my utter, utter surprise, Rose was of that opinion that I just verbalized,
yes,
like everyone else, and he was not. He kept saying, you know, Rose, I'm not too sure. I'm not too sure that we have any business invading another country for whatever. It has to really affect the security of the United States, and I don't think that we've made the case that it affects the security of the United States. So I'm quite confident on that, because I was in that conversation.
I'll take your word, Leo.
Yeah.
That's very, very interesting.
Yeah, you mentioned Rose. We shouldn't forget her.
We certainly should not.
This was a lifelong partnership, the two of them. And she was an accomplished economist in her own right, gave up her career to be his mm-hmm. partner.
And never hesitated to disagree with him.
Absolutely.
When the rest of the world might have,
yeah,
and I certainly always did, and I never openly disagreed with him. She was always, whenever she, you know, she felt that she didn't agree, she was very verbal about it. And they would have a discussion. I mean, you know, there was a good deal of give and take between them.
They did a memoir together, did they not?
Yes, I think it's after this Free to Choose. And
yeah.
It was something like a memorable, I forget the title, but very interesting. I actually read that one, and not, I saw the PBS program, I didn't read the book.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting, it was interesting to me because I knew them both personally, and I wanted to get more of the biographical aspects.
I've wanted to get from you a report on your own colleagues, post Friedman, so to speak. The Chicago School is still there. It has a distinctive style, but it's not quite the same set of concerns that we have in Friedman's Chicago School, is it?
Well, the part that's there, I mean, first of all, there is no single charismatic figure of the type that Milton Friedman was.
Well, coming close is Gary Becker, I would say.
Well, yes. Gary Becker has the same willingness to communicate with the rest of the world. Is also a Nobel laureate and
mm-hmm.
a very, very important figure in economics. But you know, with all due respect to Gary, he's not an iconic figure of this kind that Milton. Milton was unique in the sense of being a very important figure to economists and being this great figure to the rest of the world.
Well, Gary Becker's main line of work doesn't translate instantly into application to actual policy issues, does it?
Oh, no, of course it does. I mean, it depends on what aspect you're mm-hmm. you're talking about, but his work on education has a lot to implications for, we talked about vouchers and how important it is to have an efficient education system. But you're putting that to one side. I mean, there's an aspect of what is it that economists should be doing, and Milton would always say, go look at what the world actually is, not what you would like it to be. Go look and see if your theory actually explains how the world works. That spirit is still there. Now, I'm not sure it's there to the extent that it was when I was a graduate student, but times do change. I don't myself have permanent institutional loyalties that would lead me to say, well, that's terrible that it isn't exactly the way it was
on the Times bestseller list for some time. Maybe it's still there for all I know. Is a book by a young former colleague of yours, Levitt. Freakonomics, is that what he calls it?
Well, no, he's not a former guy. He's there. He's at the university now.
I know that. No, I'm merely taking into account the fact that you are officially emeritus.
Oh, officially. Yeah,
though you're working harder than you ever did.
Yeah.
Is Levitt's odd line of applying economics to areas where ordinarily it doesn't penetrate, is that in any sense continuous with the work of Milton Friedman?
I would say in some sense it is. It doesn't have the bite of what Friedman was doing with capitalism and freedom, which it was trying to show you that a very consistent set of simple principles could lead you to understand lots of different phenomena. It's much more, here's one problem, here's another, here's how I attack this problem, here is how I attack the third. But it does have this character of trying to use economics to illuminate what's going on in the world. So to that extent, yes.
There's actually a book, and I can't remember the author, it's recently published, Freedomonics.
That's John Lott.
Yes.
L-O-T-T.
And that, I think, at least my glance through it, is more a continuation of the freedom of markets that Milton promoted. So I think there's a, you know, that's a strong endorsement of those ideas, I believe.
But gentlemen, here's a very interesting email. It's rather lengthy, but it's well worth reading to you, so let me do so. Listening to the show, I find myself wondering if Friedman ever was or wanted to be involved in education at a lower level. In perusing my three kids' textbooks over many years, I honestly feel that free market theories are treated with hostility in middle and high school history, social studies, and economics, including comparative economics, textbooks. Books are often plastered with negative images of belching factories, clogged highways, etc., as if all the ills of the world should be laid at the doorstep of manufacturers. The overall lesson seems to be one of zero-sum gain, that profit always comes at someone else's expense. Passing an industrial area where I would see vigor and ingenuity, my kids would see something akin to a blight on the land. This led to some interesting discussions about consumption, production, and of course, the need for ethical business practices. Kids are getting a very incomplete picture of economics, particularly in light of the very anti-capitalist messages promulgated in pop culture. Paren, live earth anyone? Is anybody willing to stand up and advocate for free markets and capitalism? Can you make the topic sexy and hip enough for kids? That's a fascinating
and correct observation, unfortunate as it is. Milton Friedman fought this this idea for all his life. I mean, and when he began, actually, I mean, he won. In effect, he won because the world did embrace, in spite of all these images and these negativisms, which recently are on the upswing again. Unfortunately, again. But during the course of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, his ideas were embraced the world over, and it became quite obvious that the old view of capitalism, the old view of the factory being the bad guy and so forth, after all, it employs people, it gives them job, it gives them income and so forth and so on. And that view needs to be expounded on and needs to be explained in the lower schools. It's the caller, the writer is absolutely right.
But listen to this one. Here's another email from a listener who takes a somewhat different view of it all. Are your guests familiar with John Perkins' two recent books, Secret History of the American Empire and Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In them, he is highly critical of the effects of globalization on developing countries. He argues that underprivileged people in those countries are harmed by the privatization of basic services such as water and electric service, and that they are exploited through the inadequate wages and poor working conditions provided by multinational corporations. In many cases, the standard of living in developing countries has worsened as a result of, quote, development. As a further illustration, he points out the popularity of Hugo Chavez with the people of his own country, of Venezuela, as he brings portions of their economy out of the private sector. I would be interested in your guest's comments on the effects of the spread of free market capitalism in the developing world.
Well, I don't know the authors that were mentioned, but I'll let me comment generally. This is a very commonly articulated view.
It is indeed.
I think it's what Leo meant when he said we're going back a little bit now. Very commonly articulated view. It's almost completely wrong, in the sense that all you have to do is look at countries which opt out of the market. Venezuela is a very good example. Their economy is actually contracting, even though it's one of the major oil producers in the world. For them to be sitting on that much oil and having a contracting economy is, you couldn't do it if you tried. They tried and they did it. So Chavez and one or two others are exactly the exceptions which strongly prove the rule. No country which has tried to wall itself off from competition in the market is doing well. You can't show me one. On the other side, countries which did wall themselves off from the market and then went the other way tend to do well, India and China being the two most dramatic examples. Is the average Indian, you're talking about a billion people, worse off today than they were in 1992 when they made this turn? Absolutely not. You just have to open your eyes and look. So if you look at the effects of markets with a very narrow lens, and you, of course, some people are going to benefit and some people are not going to benefit, and there's going to be a lot of turnover. But if you insist on focusing on the casualties, you're going to get a very, very distorted view.
You know, two examples. One in the grand scale is the Russian Empire that walled itself off. Alan Greenspan once made the comment that it was almost like 70, 75 or 80 years ago, an experiment was made in the world, one where a free market economy was the way in which it would develop its economic fabric, and another where it would be centrally planned and command economics, as in Russia. And of course, you could, 70 years later, you could tell the difference for the benefit of the people that lived in one place or in another. Today, you have a similar kind of smaller example, but South and North Korea are terrific examples of what happens in an economy in South Korea, which is generally in a free market direction. It isn't completely so, but it is moving and has moved, and it certainly has an enormously successful economy, and the people have a standard of living that isn't even close. I mean, it can't be compared to that in North Korea, where it's a centrally command economy. So it's like Sam said, there's some negatives that along the way that are going to develop, but in the overall general result is overwhelmingly positive in a free market economy.
Let me offer you another case in point, a country that isn't doing that well. Could they profit from a strong application of Friedmanian economics? Now, what I have in mind is our neighbor to the south. Mexico's economic problems produce a lot of unemployment, a lot of misery, and drive a lot of people across the border illegally, thus creating another very interesting problem for this country. Could Mexico get a good, would Mexico profit from a real Friedmanian fix?
Well, I think so, and we have a lot of students who come from Mexico at the University of Chicago who go back and try to try to move them in the right direction. They've made some moves.
What would be the right direction for Mexico?
Well,
in terms of actual reorganization of their economy.
Well, the stable monetary background, which they've basically achieved, a legal system which you can rely on. That's they have not yet achieved. Deregulation of the economy, which they're far from achieving, but they're moving slowly in the right direction. All of those things, I think, would help.
Leo?
Well, I certainly embrace what Sam has indicated. And the interesting thing about the illegal immigration is another aspect of the same consequence. Here are people really literally taking their life in their own hands to come into this environment and this economy. Why? Because they can succeed here where they can't in Mexico under the economic programs that exist there. I mean, I still believe that for most of the world, if they were given a choice to live in the United States and have a chance at happiness and success, the world would line up in a line around the world to come to this country rather to some of the places where they live.
In fact, though, many of those Mexican workers, the illegals particularly, don't do all that well. They often burn out. They work in at labor force levels as gardeners, as agricultural workers, and in simple factory labor, and in the building trades. But they poop out with disease and with injury into their 40s, or certainly by their 50s. And then they are, in fact, on the American dole, the American medical dole as well.
Well, that's a problem.
That is a problem.
But remittances from Mexicans working in the United States to their families in Mexico is a bigger share of their GDP than you might guess.
Yes, it's about the third largest source of income. Income flowing in from outside. Yes, that's been established, and we are in the home stretch. But loads of people are lined up to put questions to Sam Peltzman and Leo Melamed, and so we go directly back to the phones on 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I've been very much enjoying your program this evening. I wanted to ask your guests what they think Mr. Freeman would think about the current immigration issue between Mexico and the United States. I have a belief that really this is really it comes down to economics, and that the policy is solely lagging behind the economics of the situation. But I would like to hear what their views on it.
That's a welcome question.
Well, he's I don't know if he's on the record, but I certainly had conversations with him where this came up. His general view was that were it not for the welfare system, we should have totally free immigration and immigration. Were it not for the welfare system. The welfare system, which is government intervention par excellence,
is a great lure.
Can be. It can be. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
If you have a completely free immigration and you have a difference in government-provided welfare systems, you may get immigration that's attracted by that. But were that not the case, you should have free immigration. So it's a roundabout way of saying that he would countenance restrictions on immigration, given that you had a welfare system, which of course we do.
All right.
Let's get a further response from Leo Melamed.
Well, I spoke with him in terms of in general. He lauded the fact that the United States was a consequence of immigration and very much the melting pot that produced this what he termed the society and environment and standard of living and ideas that sprung from those kinds of cultural differences that produced innovations such as we have and we live in the world today. So in overall terms, Milton Friedman was very much against restrictions on immigration. But what Sam is saying is correct. He's always concerned himself with the fact that if it's not equal, then of course it doesn't balance out and people come here for the so-called the wrong reason. The reason being that they could just get a free dole, maybe.
Sir, we thank you for the call. We'll go rather quickly with lots of other people waiting. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. My question originally was, what do you think Professor Friedman would have thought about global warming? But in the while I was holding, I guess my question has changed now. Did he believe that there were such things as market externalities? I'll leave it at that. I hope that's a clear enough question.
What do you mean by market externalities?
Well, I think that the global warming problem partly arises from the fact that individuals can spew out as much carbon products as they want without any individual cost that the overall environment seems to be experiencing.
I imagine one or both of you has had conversation with Milton on these matters as well.
We mentioned at the beginning of the show that Milton is a lineal descendant of Adam Smith. Yeah. Neither Milton nor Adam Smith were anarchists. They didn't believe that there was no role for government, and one of the areas in which they sanctioned the role for the government was the caller said externalities. So cases where you and I do something and it has broad negative consequences, or could have positive consequences too, but broad negative consequences that that nobody else individually can come to us and tell us, oh, I'll make a deal with you to stop doing that. So defense would be an example of a public good. Global warming may be an example of a public bad, and both in principle have some room for government action. Later in his life, he became persuaded by his fellow Nobel laureate Ronald Coase that a lot of these issues really have to do with how well you can define property rights and whether you can enforce and trade them. That's a detail that might interest economists more than it might our caller. But the overall answer is yes, he would sanction a role for a government in providing public goods like defense and in preventing public bads like pollution.
Our thanks to the caller, and quickly to yet another on 591-7200. Good evening.
Yes, I had two thoughts I'd like answered. One, since the Depression was a worldwide phenomenon, did Friedman really believe that monetary theory could quarantine the United States from a universal collapse? And the other, did not Frank Knight pioneer the ground that Friedman cultivated?
Frank Knight was Milton Friedman's teacher. Frank Knight was an economist at the University of Chicago, very much the one of the two leading figures in the Chicago school of the time. Milton Friedman was a student. Now, as far as the Depression being a worldwide phenomenon, actually it wasn't. It was there was a lot countries which were tied very closely to the American financial system suffered. Other countries didn't. It wasn't that widespread. What he believed was that all of these countries were going to central banking systems in which they were giving the government control over the money supply, and if the government had a lot of discretion, and it used that discretion badly, as inevitably it would, that you would have more instability than otherwise. Knight himself, by the way, was not a monetary economist; he was something else.
But did the Depression begin in the United States and spread to Germany, France, England, et cetera?
No, you had a stock market crash, which would have caused the contraction not only in the United States, but in every economy that was closely tied to the United States. You also had monetary policies in other countries which were similar enough to ours that they exacerbated the situation. But the American economy was too big then to not affect the rest of the world.
Our thanks to the caller. Gentlemen, we've got only about a minute and a half left. What would one recommend by way of works by Milton Friedman for the general public? What particular books, or for that matter, other articles, wherever you might find them, would give a fuller understanding of this?
I mean, Capitalism and Freedom is probably the basic tenets.
That's the
one that I would say is a must read for almost everybody to understand what Milton Friedman promoted, what was his theme ideas that won the day, as it were.
I would absolutely agree. If you're going to read one thing by him, it should be Capitalism and Freedom, and you should read it with an eye to how much of what you're reading is actually either being discussed, moved toward being implemented, or actually has been implemented. And with the knowledge that that was written 40 years ago when this man was thought to be a lunatic.
Yeah, that I think is the essence of it. It took over 40 years for his ideas to be understood and to prevail.
And now they are essentially consensual, at least in your profession.
I wouldn't say. I think we've moved a long way. I've seen it all. I've seen it come from the lunatic fringe to become part of the mainstream.